barn, the first such project he had ever undertaken. "This day my new barn was raised, near the spot where my father raised his new barn in 1737, he recorded on July 13th. He thought it looked very stately and strong. He kept 3 to 10 men at work through the summer, including John Breisler, another of the numerous Bass family, Seth Bass, and a hard-drinking neighbor named Billings, who was an especially hard worker. After the sedentary life of the Senate, Adams relished the days out of doors. He loved the work, the tangible results, the feeling that he had not only returned home, but returned, if only for a while, to the ways of his father and generations of Adamses. July 15th, Friday. Went with 3 hands to cut between 40 and 50 red cedars, and with a team of 5 cattle brought home 22 of them at a load. We have opened the prospect so that the meadows and western mountain may be distinctly seen. July 16th. We got in 2 loads of English hay. July 20th. Walked in the afternoon over the hills and across the fields and meadows up to the old plain. The corn is as good there as any I've seen. August 2nd. Finished the Great Wall on Penn's Hill. August 5th. Sullivan and Mr. Sam Hayward threshing, Billings and Bass carting earth and seaweed and liming the compost. He was up each morning with the birds, drank his usual gill of hard cider, and with Abigail passed quiet evenings reading, writing letters, or keeping up with his diary, where, along with the Chronicle of Daily Enterprises, he wrote of clear summer skies and described a morning shower as a soft, fine rain in a clock calm, falling as sweetly as I ever saw in April. Ever the realist, he wrote, too, of rattlesnakes and cornworms, Hessian flies, and mosquitoes numerous. Though Abigail's health remained a worry, she apparently felt well enough to entertain Parson Wybird at dinner and to ride to Weymouth to dine with Cotton Tufts, whose salted beef, shell beans, and whortleberry pudding Adams proclaimed luxurious. "Of all the summers of my life," he recorded, "this has been the freest from care, anxiety, and vexation to me. The sickness of Mrs. A. excepted." "Billings and Prince laying wall," he wrote September 8th. "Breisler and James picking apples and making cider. Stetson widening the brook. I think to christen my place Peacefield, in commemoration of the peace which I assisted in making in 1783, of the 13 years' peace and neutrality which I have contributed to preserve, and of the constant peace and tranquility which I have enjoyed in this residence." Though politics through the summer of 1796 had been in a perfect calm, as Abigail noted, neither she nor John had any illusions about what was to come. Mischief was surely brewing in the Jacobin cauldron, she wrote, as venomous as Macbeth's hell broth. When the Boston papers carried news of Washington's retirement and the text of his farewell address of September 17th, it was, as said, as if a hat had been dropped to start the race. Adams and Jefferson were the leading candidates in what was the first presidential election with 2 parties in opposition, an entirely new experience for the country. Jefferson remained at Monticello, Adams at Peacefield, neither taking any part in what quickly became a vicious all-out battle. Adams was pilloried in the Republican press as a gross and shameless monarchist. His rotundity, whose majestic appearance was so much sesquipedality of belly, as said Bache's Aurora. Adams declared the widely read paper was unfit to lead the country. And beneath a headline declaring an alarm, Bache warned that unless by their votes the people were to call forth Thomas Jefferson, the friend of the people, Adams, the champion of kings, ranks, and titles, would be their president. Were Adams to be elected, warned the Boston Chronicle, the principle of hereditary succession would be imposed on America to make way for John Quincy. With Jefferson, said the paper, no one need worry, since Jefferson had only daughters. To add further fuel to the fire, Thomas Paine, in a fury over the Jay Treaty, unleashed an unprecedented attack on George Washington in the pages of the Aurora. Writing from Paris, Paine called Washington a creature of grossest adulation, a man incapable of friendship, a hypocrite in public life, apostate and impostor. For their part, the Federalists were hardly less abusive. Jefferson was decried as a Jacobin, an atheist, and charged with cowardice for having fled Monticello from the British cavalry in 1781. "Poor Jefferson is tortured as much as your better acquaintance," Adams wrote to John Quincy. The candidates for vice president were Aaron Burr of New York for the Republicans, and for the Federalists, Thomas Pinckney of South Carolina, thus providing regional balance on both sides. Adams was expected to carry New England, Jefferson the South, while the middle states could go either way. To add to Adams's troubles, Alexander Hamilton was up to his old tricks behind the scenes, urging the strongest possible support for Thomas Pinckney, ostensibly as a way to keep Jefferson from becoming vice president, but also it was suspected to defeat Adams as well and make Pinckney president, Pinckney being someone Hamilton could more readily control. The rumors of this that reached Adams at Quincy would be confirmed before the year was out by his old friend Elbridge Gerry, who was a presidential elector for Massachusetts and, like Adams, an ardent anti-party man. For both John and Abigail, Gerry's report marked the end of whatever remaining trust or respect they had for Hamilton. Abigail henceforth referred to him privately as Cassius. John called him as great a hypocrite as any in the U.S. His intrigues in the election I despise. For all the clamor over politics, the country was still at peace and more prosperous than ever. If there was a prevailing sentiment overall concerning national politics, it was one of regret, even sadness, that Washington would soon be stepping down. Abigail expressed what most Americans felt when, quoting Shakespeare, she wrote of Washington, "Take his character altogether, and we shall not look upon his like again." On November 23rd, Adams bid her goodbye and started for Philadelphia, and again by public conveyance, John Breisler, his sole companion. "Fear takes no hold of me," he assured Abigail, as if to boost both their spirits. He reached Philadelphia on December 4th, and the night of December 7th, struggling with the prospect of defeat, he wrote again, "I laugh at myself 20 times a day for my feelings and the meditations and speculations in which I find myself engaged. Vanity suffers. Cold feelings of unpopularity. Humble reflections. Mortifications. Humiliation. Plans of future life. Economy. Retrenching expenses. Farming. Returning to the bar. Drawing writs, arguing causes, taking clerks. I can pronounce Thomas Jefferson to be chosen President of the United States with firmness and a good grace that I don't fear. But here, alone, abed by my fireside, nobody to speak to, pouring upon my disgrace and future prospects, this is ugly." But in a week or so, in an entirely different mood, he was writing to tell her it appeared he would be elected president. Though the final count would not be known until February when the electors met, it was being said openly in and out of Congress that he had won, and that Jefferson was to be vice president. Overnight, Adams was being treated as though suddenly he had become a different man, and this he found most remarkable. Even Bache's Aurora seemed to experience a miraculous change of heart. John Adams, the paper now declared, was clearly preferable to Washington. There can be no doubt that Adams would not be a puppet, that having an opinion and judgment of his own, he would act from his own impulses rather than the impulses of others, that possessing great integrity, he would not sacrifice his country's interests at the shrine of party. In addition, it is well known that Adams is an aristocrat only in theory, but that Washington is one in practice. That Adams has the simplicity of a Republican, but that Washington has the ostentation of an Eastern Bashaw. That Adams holds none of his fellow men in slavery, but Washington does. The difference is immense. To Adams's particular delight, one of the most partisan of all the young Republicans, Representative William Branch Giles of Virginia, had been heard to say of him, "The old man will make a good president, too." At Monticello, Jefferson received word from Madison that he should be prepared for the likelihood of finishing second, and that for the good of the country and the valuable effect of his influence on Adams, he must accept the vice presidency. In reply, Jefferson expressed no reluctance to serve under Adams, since he had always been my senior from the commencement of my public life. Then, 3 days after Christmas, Jefferson took up his pen to write an extraordinary letter to Adams. From his latest information, Jefferson said, it appeared Adams's election to the first magistracy was an established fact. But to Jefferson, this had never been in doubt. "I have never one single moment expected a different issue." And though he knew he would not be believed, it was true nonetheless that he never wished it otherwise. He warned that Hamilton had been up to some of his usual schemes, but doubted it would change the outcome. "I leave to others the sublime delights of riding in the storm, better pleased with sound sleep and a warm berth below, with the society of neighbors, friends, and fellow laborers of the earth than of spies and sycophants. No one then will congratulate you with purer disinterestedness than myself. I have no ambition to govern men. It is a painful and thankless office. I devoutly wish you may be able to shun for us this war by which our agriculture, commerce, and credit will be destroyed. If you are, the glory will be all your own, and that your administration may be filled with glory and happiness to yourself and advantage to us, is the sincere wish of one who, though in the course of our voyage through life various little incidents have happened or been contrived to separate us, retains still for you the solid esteem of the moments when we were working for our independence, and sentiments of respect and affectionate attachment." It was a fine show of magnanimity in defeat, as well as one of the warmest expressions of friendship Jefferson ever wrote, or that anyone had ever addressed to Adams. But after finishing the letter, Jefferson had second thoughts and sent it on to Madison in Philadelphia, "open for your perusal, so that if anything he had written should render the delivery of it ineligible in your opinion, you may return it to me." Madison was appalled. He saw the letter as a dreadful mistake, and decided it must go no further. As he explained delicately to Jefferson, friendship was one thing, politics another. Adams already knew of his friendship, Madison advised, and were Adams to prove a failure as president, such compliments and confidence in him as Jefferson had put in writing could prove politically embarrassing. The letter was never sent. It remained in Madison's possession, in a file only a few blocks from where Adams resided. For Adams, it could have been one of the most important letters he ever received. Jefferson's praise, his implicit confidence in him, his rededication to their old friendship would have meant the world to Adams, and never more than now, affecting his entire outlook and possibly with consequent effect on the course of events to follow. Not long after, however, Adams did receive a letter from Abigail, written at Quincy on January 15, 1797. "The cold has been more severe than I can ever before recollect. It has frozen the ink in my pen and chilled the blood in my veins. But not the warmth of my affection for him for whom my heart beats with unabated ardor through all the changes and vicissitudes of life, in the still calm of Peacefield, and the turbulent scenes in which he is about to engage." Chapter 9. Old Oak. The task of the president is very arduous, very perplexing, and very hazardous. I do not wonder Washington wished to retire from it, or rejoiced in seeing an old oak in his place. Abigail Adams. Section 1. The inauguration of the second President of the United States commenced in the first floor House Chamber of Congress Hall in Philadelphia just before noon, Saturday, March 4, 1797. The room was filled to overflowing. Every seat taken by members of the House and Senate, justices of the Supreme Court, heads of departments, the diplomatic corps, and many ladies said to have added a welcome note of brilliancy to the otherwise solemn occasion. There was a burst of applause when George Washington entered and walked to the dais. More applause followed on the appearance of Thomas Jefferson, who had been inaugurated vice president upstairs in the Senate earlier that morning, and, like marks of approbation, greeted John Adams, who on his entrance in the wake of the two tall Virginians seemed shorter and more bulky even than usual. It was a scene few who were present would ever forget. Here were the three who, more than any others, had made the revolution, and as many in the audience supposed, it was to be the last time they would ever appear on the same platform. Adams felt as he had when he first appeared before George III, as if he were on stage playing a part. It was, he later told Abigail, "the most affecting and overpowering scene I ever acted in." Jefferson's height was accentuated by a long blue frock coat. Washington was in a dress suit of black velvet. Adams, the plainest of the three, wore a suit of gray broadcloth intentionally devoid of fancy buttons and knee buckles. Resolved to keep things as understated as possible, he had ridden to Congress Hall from his lodgings at the Francis Hotel in a simple but elegant enough carriage drawn by just two horses. The grand carriage and six white horses of Washington's first inauguration had been dispensed with. Nor would Adams allow an official retinue to march in procession with him. As he confided to Abigail, he wanted few, if any, of the court trappings of his predecessor. On learning that she had had the Quincy coat of arms painted on her carriage at home, he told her to have it painted out. "They shall have a Republican president in earnest," he wrote. Overcast skies had cleared by noon. The day turned bright and cloudless. But for Adams, there was little cheer. With none of his family present, he felt miserably alone. He had been unable to sleep the night before, sick with worry that he might not make it through the ceremony without fainting. But he succeeded with flying colors, delivering an address that left little doubt as to where he stood on the Constitution, partisan politics, domestic concerns, France, and the pressing issue of peace or war. though in print the speech would seem a bit stilted. It was delivered with great force and effect. Stirred by emotion and in a strong voice, Adams recalled the old ardor of the American Revolution and spoke of the present happy Constitution as the creation of good heads prompted by good hearts. In answer to concerns about his political creed, he expressed total attachment to and veneration for the present system of a free Republican government. What other form of government, indeed, can so well deserve our esteem and love? He spoke of his respect for the rights of all states and of his belief in expanded education for all the people, both to enlarge the happiness of life and as essential to the preservation of freedom. The great threats to the nation, Adams warned, were sophistry, the spirit of party, and the pestilence of foreign influence. He paid gracious tribute to Washington's leadership. He lauded American agriculture and manufacturing, pledged himself to a spirit of equity and humanity toward the American Indian, to ameliorate their condition by inclining them to be more friendly to us, and our citizens to be more friendly to them. To Abigail, he would later write, "I have been so strangely used in this country, so belied and so undefended, that I was determined to say some things as an appeal to posterity." But the strongest lines, those underscoring his determination to maintain American neutrality, were delivered directly for the benefit of Congress and the foreign diplomats present, not to say the opposition press. It was his inflexible determination to maintain peace with all nations, Adams declared, then expressed a personal esteem for France, stemming from a residence of nearly 7 years there. Finally, he affirmed an unshaken confidence in the spirit of the American people, on which I have often hazarded my all. Then, having issued a solemn invocation of the Supreme Being, he stepped down from the platform to a table at the front of the chamber, where Chief Justice Oliver Ellsworth administered the oath of office, Adams energetically repeating the words. And so Adams became president of the nation that now, with the additions of Vermont, Kentucky, and Tennessee, numbered 16 states. Having never in his public life held an administrative position, having never played any but a marginal role in the previous administration, having never served in the military, or campaigned for a single vote, or claimed anything like a political bent, he was now chief executive and commander-in-chief. Many in the chamber were weeping, moved by his words, but still more, it seems, by the prospect of Washington's exit from the national stage. "A solemn scene it was indeed," Adams wrote, noting that Washington's face remained as serene and unclouded as the day. "Methought I heard him think, 'Aye, I am fairly out, and you are fairly in. See which of us will be the happiest.'" Approval came from all sides. Federalist Senator Theodore Sedgwick of Massachusetts called it the most august and sublime occasion he ever attended. Praise in the Federalist press, too, was not so much for Adams as for the occasion. Thus ended a scene the parallel of which was never before witnessed in any country. But Republicans openly extolled what the new president had said. In the pages of the Aurora, Benjamin Franklin Bache proclaimed John Adams a hero in a way inconceivable before, lauding the Republican plainness of Adams's appearance, his true dignity, his incorruptible integrity. In all, it was one of the handsomest tributes ever paid to Adams. "It is universally admitted that Mr. Adams is a man of incorruptible integrity, and that the resources of his own mind are equal to the duties of his station. We may flatter ourselves that his measures will be taken with prudence, that he will not become the head of a party, and that he will not be the tool of any man or set of men. His speech on the inauguration augurs well to our country. He declares himself the friend of France and of peace, the admirer of republicanism, the enemy of party, and he vows his determination to let no political creed interfere in his appointments. How honorable are these sentiments! How characteristic of a patriot! It was praise Adams took with a large grain of salt, suspecting Bache of wanting only to create a coolness between me and Mr. Washington. More to his liking was an item in a Baltimore paper describing him as an old fielder, which, as he explained to Abigail, is a tough, hardy, laborious little horse that works very hard and lives upon very little, very useful to his master at small expense. Both before and after his inauguration, dozens of old friends, including some like Benjamin Rush, who had supported Jefferson in the election, made a point of expressing confidence in Adams. Elbridge Gerry likened him to a ship ballasted with iron, capable of riding out any storm. Cotton Tufts, in a letter lamenting the vexation Adams was bound to encounter, wrote, "I will not, however, admit this to be of weight sufficient to deter or prevent a great and good man." A letter from Samuel Adams, then in his 75th year, may have meant the most of all. "I congratulate you as the first citizen of the United States. I may add the world. I am, my dear sir, notwithstanding I have been otherwise represented in party papers, your old and unvaried friend." Except for his siege of anxiety the night before the inauguration, Adams's state of mind had remained quite steady. He had never felt easier, he assured Abigail. And a diary entry of the wife of the British ambassador seems to bear him out. At a dinner given by Washington in mid-January, Henrietta Liston found herself seated between the president and the vice president, between the rising and setting suns. And though she found Washington as noble as expected, Adams proved surprisingly entertaining. There is a good deal of amusement in the conversation of Adams, a considerable degree of wit and humor, she recorded happily. While he knew much patience would be called for in time to come, Adams reminded Abigail that he had had a good education in patience in his years in public life, and could look at a storm with some composure. Constituted as he was, he may even have welcomed a storm. When in the pre-dawn hours of January 27th, a terrible fire ripped through the home and shop of the Philadelphia printer and publisher of the Federal Gazette, Andrew Brown, taking the lives of his wife and children, Adams was conspicuous among the men handing up buckets to fight the blaze. Brown, as all knew, had for some time been excoriating the vice president at every chance. In February, when the outcome of the election became official, it had been Adams's role as president of the Senate to open and read the final votes in the Electoral College. He had won by only a narrow margin, with 71 votes to Jefferson's 68. Pinckney had 59, Burr 30, Samuel Adams 11. As Adams himself observed, he was president by 3 votes. Yet he appears to have taken it in stride. "I am not alarmed," he told Nabby, who had written to express her concern. "If the way to do good to my country were to render myself popular, I could easily do it. But extravagant popularity is not the road to public advantage." To Abigail, he wrote simply, "The die is cast." With the inauguration still to come, he had taken one of the most fateful steps of his presidency. Rather than choosing a new cabinet of his own, Adams asked Washington's 4 department heads to stay on, convinced this was the surest way to preserve Federalist harmony. "Washington had appointed them, and I knew it would turn the world upside down if I removed any one of them," he later wrote. I had then no particular objection to any of them. Also, there was no tradition of cabinet members resigning their positions at the end of a president's term. Washington himself had encouraged them to remain, nor did any express a wish to leave. They were Secretary of State Timothy Pickering of Salem, Massachusetts, Secretary of the Treasury Oliver Wolcott, Jr. of Connecticut, Secretary of War James McHenry of Maryland, and Charles Lee of Virginia, the Attorney General. All were younger men than Adams. Wolcott, the youngest at 37, was the son of the Oliver Wolcott with whom Adams had served in the Continental Congress. A plump, rather pleasant-looking lawyer who had been educated at Yale, he was thought trustworthy and affable. McHenry, an even friendlier and more likable man, had been born and raised in County Antrim, Ireland, and spoke with a trace of an Irish accent. Charles Lee, like Wolcott, was still in his 30s, a graduate of the College of New Jersey at Princeton, and while perfectly competent, was distinguished primarily for being a Lee of Virginia. None were of outstanding ability, but all were Federalists, and Wolcott and McHenry, like Secretary of State Pickering, were extreme Federalists, or high Federalists. They belonged to the ardently anti-French, pro-British wing of the party, who considered Alexander Hamilton their leader. And because of this, and the fact that they had served in the Washington cabinet, they were inclined to look down on John Adams. But of the four, it was Timothy Pickering who held the strongest views, and as Secretary of State was the most important, given the precarious nature of a world at war, as well as his own obdurate personality. Pickering was not an easy man to like or get along with, even under normal circumstances, as Adams knew. In many ways, Pickering might have served as the model New Englander for those who disliked the type. Tall, lean, and severe-looking, with a lantern jaw and hard blue eyes, he was Salem-born and bred, a Harvard graduate, proud, opinionated, self-righteous, and utterly humorless. After brief service on Washington's staff during the war, he had been promoted to adjutant general. Later, he became the first postmaster general, and from there moved over to replace Henry Knox as Secretary of War. When Secretary of State Edmund Randolph was forced to resign under a cloud of suspicion, a cloud largely of Pickering's making, Pickering was named to succeed him, but only after Washington had been turned down by five others to whom he offered the position. To his credit, Pickering was energetic and conscientious. He was fond of music and enjoyed a happy marriage that had produced 10 children. Adams, who had known him for years, though not well, was willing to give him, indeed all of his cabinet, the benefit of the doubt. "Pickering and all his colleagues are as much attached to me as I desire," he told Elbridge Gerry. To many, the great question was the part Jefferson might play concerning relations with France. The Republicans, hoping it would be considerable, the Federalists determined he should have no say whatever. Privately, Adams was ambivalent on the subject. While he had forgiven Jefferson most of his past trespasses, he had by no means forgotten them. "I may say to you that his patronage of Paine and Freneau and his entanglements with characters and politics which have been pernicious are and have been a source of inquietude and anxiety to me," Adams confided to Tristram Dalton. "He will have too many French about him to flatter him, but I hope we can keep him steady." To Elbridge Gerry, however, Adams expressed greater confidence. In view of Jefferson's good sense and long friendship, Adams thought he could expect from his vice president support of the kind he himself had given Washington, "which is and shall be the pride and boast of my life." Benjamin Rush, meantime, had written to Jefferson to say what a lift it gave him to hear Adams speak with pleasure of the prospect of administering the government in a connection with you. "He does justice to you upon all occasions." Arriving in Philadelphia just days before the inauguration, Jefferson had called on Adams at the Francis Hotel, where Jefferson, too, was to stay. They had not seen one another for 3 years, and apparently the reunion went well. As a matter of courtesy, one such visit between the President and Vice President would have sufficed, but the fact that Adams promptly returned the call the next morning was taken as a clear signal that Adams meant truly to pursue a policy above party divisions. According to Jefferson's account of the meeting, written years later, Adams entered immediately into discussion of the crisis at hand and his wish for Jefferson to play a lead part in resolving it. Faced with the prospect of war with France, Adams was determined to make a fresh effort at negotiations in Paris, to bring about a reconciliation, which he believed possible and desirable. "Great is the guilt of an unnecessary war," he had written to Abigail. The government of France, led since 1795 by a five-headed executive commission known as the Directory, had chosen to interpret the Jay Treaty as an Anglo-American alliance. In an effort to improve relations with France, Washington had recalled the American minister, James Monroe, and sent in his place a staunch Federalist, General Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina. But as yet, there was no word from Pinckney. It was the first wish of his heart, Adams told Jefferson, to send him to Paris, though he supposed this would be out of the question. It did not seem justifiable for him to send away the person destined to take his place in case of an accident to himself, Jefferson would recall, nor decent to remove from consideration one who was a rival for public favor. Jefferson agreed with Adams's reasoning. Irrespective of whether the Constitution would allow it, he was sick of residing in Europe, Jefferson said, and hoped never to cross the Atlantic again as long as he lived. That being so, Adams continued, it was his plan to send two emissaries to join Pinckney, making it a bipartisan three-man commission, which by its dignity ought to satisfy France, and by its geographical and political balance satisfy both parties and all parts of the country. He had in mind Elbridge Gerry and James Madison, who had recently retired from Congress. Jefferson said he was certain Madison would not accept, but, at Adams's request, agreed to inquire. This was on March 3rd, the day before the inauguration. The next morning, in his own brief inaugural remarks before the Senate, Jefferson made a point of commending Adams as that eminent character and spoke of their uninterrupted friendship. For a fleeting interlude, the prospect of truly nonpartisan cooperation between them appeared attainable. "I am much pleased," one Supreme Court justice wrote, "that Mr. Adams and Mr. Jefferson lodge together. The thing looks well. It carries conciliation and healing with it, and may have a happy effect on parties." The day following the inauguration, however, when President Adams asked others, including Washington, for their opinion on sending Madison to Paris, he heard only stiff objections. To such high Federalists as Timothy Pickering and Secretary of the Treasury Wolcott, Madison was as unacceptable as Jefferson would have been. Wolcott told the President that sending Madison would "make dire work among the passions of our parties in Congress." When Adams said he refused to be intimidated by party passions, Wolcott threatened to resign. As Jefferson would recall, it was that evening while walking down Market Street with Adams, after a farewell dinner given by Washington, that he informed Adams of Madison's refusal to go to France. Adams indicated that, in any event, the issue was now academic. There had been a change of mind due to objections raised. To Jefferson, it was clear that Adams, who imagined he might steer impartially between the parties, had been brought abruptly back into the Federalist fold. But it was also clear to Adams that neither Jefferson nor Madison had the least desire to work with the administration, and thus he could expect no help from any of the Republicans. It was there, on Market Street, according to Jefferson, that he and Adams reached the breaking point. Adams never again mentioned a word to him on the subject of France, or ever consulted me as to any measures of the government. Whether the parting was quite so clear-cut as Jefferson remembered is uncertain. But as Adams, too, later acknowledged, they consulted very little together afterward. Adams was to call on his vice president for advice no more than Washington had called on him. The great difference, however, was that Jefferson was of the opposing party, with differing objectives and principles, and Adams consequently could never count on such loyalty from Jefferson as he had given Washington. Adams never knew when Jefferson might be working secretly to undercut or thwart him. For Jefferson's abiding flaw, Adams had concluded, was want of sincerity. In his farewell address, Washington had warned against the baneful effects of the spirit of party. Particularly in governments of popular form, he had said, it is seen in its greatest rankness and is truly their worst enemy. Yet party spirit and animosities were as alive as ever, as Adams had been shown in the bluntest of terms in little more than 24 hours since taking office. On March 8th, Washington called at the Francis Hotel to say goodbye to Adams and wish him well. They were parting on good terms. For all his long coolness toward Adams, Washington, before leaving office, had written an unsolicited letter expressing the strong hope that as president, Adams would not withhold merited promotion from John Quincy. "I give it as my decided opinion," Washington wrote, "that Mr. John Quincy Adams is the most valuable public character we have abroad, and there remains no doubt in my mind that he will prove himself to be the ablest of all our diplomatic corps if he is now to be brought into that line or into any other public work." Little that Washington might have said or done could have meant more to Adams. "The president is fortunate to get off just as the bubble is bursting, leaving others to hold the bag," Jefferson wrote to Madison. "Yet as his departure will mark the moment when the difficulties begin to work, you will see that they will be ascribed to the new administration." Jefferson, too, would depart shortly after a quick farewell to Adams. "He is, as he was," Adams noted cryptically. So much had happened in John Adams's life. He had done so much, taken such risks, given so much of himself, heart and soul, in the cause of his country, that he seems not to have viewed the presidency as an ultimate career objective or crowning life achievement. He was not one given to seeing life as a climb to the top of a ladder or mountain, but more as a journey or adventure, even a kind of romance, which, a little embellished with fiction or exaggeration or only poetical ornament, would equal anything in the days of chivalry or knight-errantry, as once he confided to Abigail. If anything, he was inclined to look back upon the long struggle for independence as the proud defining chapter. In this sense, the presidency was but another episode in the long journey, and, as fate would have it, he was left little time to dwell overly on anything but the rush of events and the increasingly dangerous road ahead. "My entrance into office is marked by a misunderstanding with France, which I shall endeavor to reconcile," he wrote to John Quincy, "provided that no violation of faith, no stain upon honor is exacted. America is not scared." On the evening of March 13th, or possibly the next morning, Adams was hit with stunning news. The French Directory had refused to receive General Pinckney. Forced to leave Paris as though he were an undesirable alien, Pinckney had withdrawn to Amsterdam and was awaiting instructions. To make matters worse, Adams learned of further French seizures of American ships in the Caribbean, and that by decrees issued in Paris, the Directory had, in effect, launched an undeclared war on American shipping everywhere. The crisis had come to a head. Adams faced the threat of all-out war. Days were consumed by tedious meetings. The weather was miserable, he reported to Abigail. I have a great cold. The news is not pleasant. Such confidence in his cabinet as he had expressed to Elbridge Gerry was badly shaken. From what he wrote privately to Abigail, it appears he already sensed what trouble was in store from that quarter. From the situation where I now am, I see a scene of ambition beyond all my former suspicions or imagination. Jealousies and rivalries never stared me in the face in such horrid forms as in the present. On March 21st, he moved into the President's house, vacated by Washington, but what should rightfully have been a fulfilling moment proved only more demoralizing. The furniture belonging to the public is in the most deplorable condition, he reported to Abigail. There is not a chair to sit in. The beds and bedding are in a woeful pickle. This house has been a scene of the most scandalous drinking and disorder among the servants that I ever heard of. I would not have one of them for any consideration. There is not a carpet, nor a curtain, nor a glass, mirror, nor linen, nor china, nor anything. Rent for the house was an exorbitant $2,700 a year, plus another $2,500 for carriages and horses. Though Congress would allot $14,000 to purchase furniture, Adams worried that on his salary of $25,000, it would be impossible to make ends meet. They would be more pinched than ever in their lives, he warned Abigail. All the glasses, ornaments, kitchen furniture, all to purchase. All the china, glass and crockery. All the linen besides. Secretaries, servants, wood, charities. The million dittos. Yet not a word could they say. We must stand our ground as long as we can. To no one but her could he ever complain. The work was more taxing than he had been prepared for. Very dry, dull, perplexing, and incessant. But again, nothing could be said. Don't expose this croaking and groaning. I should lose all my character reputation for firmness. Indeed, I sometimes suspect that I deserve a character of peevishness and fretfulness rather than firmness. But more was happening than he let on. On Saturday, March 25th, he called for Congress to reconvene in special session on May 15th to consult and determine on such measures as their wisdom shall be deemed meet for the safety and welfare of the United States. War clouds gathered over the Capitol, to the angry indignation of the Republicans. The Federalist Press declared the United States had been grievously insulted by France. The Republican press affirmed American friendship with the French, and while expressing the hope that the president would remain true to his inaugural pledge to seek peace, reported that a certain ex-secretary, Hamilton, was secretly preaching war to further his political ambitions. A lively new newspaper had begun publication in Philadelphia, in answer to Bache's Aurora. Porcupine's Gazette was the work of an English printer and bookseller, William Cobbett, who wrote under the pen name Peter Porcupine, and immediately demonstrated that he could be as biased, sarcastic, and full of invective as Bache and attract no less attention. Headlines in Porcupine's Gazette announced that war with France was all but certain. Mr. Pinckney, the American minister at Paris, having received orders to quit the territories of the French Republic, has actually taken his departure accordingly. War between these two powers may therefore be considered inevitable. Cobbett not only expected and wanted war with France, but favored the alliance with Britain that was bound to result, an increasingly popular view in many quarters. It is manifestly the design of the French party to lull the people into a fatal security, to deaden their national energy, and to defeat in this way those measures of defense which would secure to us our independence. With this view, they will fabricate reports of accommodation with France, For this end, they are constantly preaching up the improbability of a war with that nation. And some of the base traitors have even declared that in the event of war, they will join France. Adams remained silent. But in letters to Henry Knox and John Quincy, he said he would do everything possible to settle all disputes with France. To Abigail, he confessed to being totally exhausted and begged her to come to his rescue. The more at odds he felt with his cabinet, the less he trusted their judgment. The greater his need for her insight and common sense, her presence in his life. His pleas for her to come grew more urgent even than those he had sent during his difficult debut as vice president. "I must go to you, or you must come to me. I cannot live without you," he wrote. And again, "I must entreat you to lose not a moment's time in preparing to come on, that you may take off from me every care of life but that of my public duty. Assist me with your counsels, and console me with your conversation. The times are critical and dangerous, and I must have you here to assist me," he told her. "I must now repeat this with zeal and earnestness. I can do nothing without you." Abigail had been corresponding faithfully the whole time, offering advice, opinions on people, often saying more than she knew she should as the wife of a president. "My pen runs riot," she allowed. "I forget that it must grow cautious and prudent." She had encouraged his confidence in Jefferson. Like others, she had thought the odd circumstance of having a president and vice president of differing sentiments could prove a blessing were both to aim at the same end, the good of their country. Conceivably, the combination of two well-meaning men could serve to continue the Union as Washington had managed all alone. When Adams confided that he hoped to keep Hamilton at a safe distance, she provided a withering, far-sighted assessment. "Beware that spare Cassius has always occurred to me when I have seen that cock sparrow," she wrote. "Oh, I have read his heart in his wicked eyes. The very devil is in them. They are lasciviousness itself." She prayed that things which made for peace may not be hid from your eyes. Her feelings were not those of pride or ostentation, but solemnized by the knowledge of the obligations and duties he had assumed. "That you may be enabled to discharge them with honor to yourself, with justice and impartiality to your country, and with the satisfaction to this great people shall be the daily prayer of your A.A." Her own days were taken up with all that would have preoccupied him had he been home, and more. She kept house, ran the farm, settled issues among the hired men, managed the family finances, and tried not to complain about her health or loneliness. In a particularly memorable letter, she recounted a crisis that arose when the youngest of her hired hands, James Prince, a free black boy she had taken under her wing in Philadelphia, came to ask if he might attend evening classes in town at a new school for apprentices. Abigail, who had taught him herself to read and write, warmly approved, but was soon asked by a neighbor to withdraw James. If she did not, she was told, the other boys would refuse to attend and the school would close. Had James misbehaved? Abigail asked. No, she was informed, it was because he was black. Did these other boys object when he attended church? No, they did not. The boy is a free man as much as any of the young men, and merely because his face is black is he to be denied instruction? She asked. How is he to be qualified to procure a livelihood? Is this the Christian principle of doing unto others as we would have others to do to us? She requested that the boys be sent to her. Tell them that I hope we shall all go to heaven together. And this, she was pleased to report to Adams, ended the crisis. She heard no more on the subject. James continued in the school. As ever, a very considerable part of her time was devoted to correspondence with the rest of the family, about whom she reported to John, seldom withholding her own opinions. John Quincy was in love again, this time with Louisa Catherine Johnson, the daughter of the American consul in London whom the Adamses knew. Though John Quincy assured his mother that his matrimonial prospects were still uncertain, she could not help worrying, as she told him, whether the young woman was right for him, whether she might be too young, too accustomed to the splendors and attractions of Europe, meaning her expensive tastes might be more than he could afford. "All your observations on the subject are received by me with gratitude, as I knew them to proceed from serious concern and purest parental affection," answered the young diplomat. The lady in question had goodness of heart and gentleness of disposition, as well as spirit and discretion, and would prove such a daughter as you would wish for your son. "My fear arose from the youth and inexperience of the lady," Abigail wrote in reply, "and asked John Quincy to please tell Louisa that I consider her already my daughter." Her greater concern was still over Nabby, whose husband, Colonel Smith, Abigail had sadly concluded, was a man wholly devoid of judgment. He had deceived himself with his visionary schemes and led his family into a state of living which I fear his means will not bear him out. In April, as Abigail was preparing to leave for Philadelphia, the weather turned unseasonably hot. Then, as suddenly, the temperature plunged, and John's aged mother went into a sharp decline. "The good old lady is sure she shall die now that her physician and nurse are about to leave her, but she judges with me that all ought to be forsaken for the husband," Abigail informed John. Refusing to leave, she was with his mother until the end came on April 21st, and it was she who made arrangements for the funeral in her front parlor. "I prepare to set out on the morrow," she wrote to John on April 26th. "Our aged parent has gone to rest. She fell asleep and is happy. I am ready and willing to follow my husband wherever he chooses." The obituary that appeared in the Boston papers noted that Susanna Boylston Adams Hall, mother of the President of the United States, who died in the 89th year of her life, had afforded the present generation a living example of that simplicity of manners and godly sincerity for which the venerable settlers of this country were so justly esteemed. From Philadelphia, Adams wrote to Abigail to express his grief and the wish that he had been at Quincy to give her help and comfort. "Our ancestors are now all gone, and we are to follow them very soon to a country where there will be no war or rumor of war, no envy, no jealousy, rivalry, or party. You and I are entering on a new scene, which will be the most difficult and least agreeable of any in our lives. I hope the burden will be lighter to both of us when we come together." Her journey south was extremely difficult because of heavy rains and washed-out roads. "She felt like Noah's dove," Abigail wrote, her thoughts always returning to the ark she had left. The part she must play now as wife of the president, though enviable, no doubt, in the eyes of some, was one she had never envied or wanted. "That I may discharge my part with honor and give satisfaction is my most earnest wish." Stopping to see Nabby at Eastchester, she was stunned to find that Colonel Smith was off again on another of his uncertain ventures, and Nabby too upset even to talk about it, except to say she had no idea where he was. "My reflections upon prospects there took from me all appetite for food," Abigail confided to her sister Mary, "and depressed my spirits before too low." Expecting her to arrive at Philadelphia on May 10th, Adams set off that morning by carriage and met her about 25 miles outside the city. "I quitted my own carriage and took my seat by his side," she wrote. "We rode on to Bristol, where I had previously engaged a dinner, and there upon the banks of the Delaware we spent the day getting into the city at sunset." It took several days for her to recover from the trip, but in little time she, too, was caught up in the tumult of events. One day later, on May 11th, Thomas Jefferson arrived in Philadelphia from Monticello to find the city astir over a private letter he had written more than a year before that had just appeared in print in the New York Minerva, a strongly Federalist paper edited by Noah Webster. Writing to an Italian friend, Philip Mazzei, during the debate over the Jay Treaty, Jefferson had described America as a country taken over by timid men who prefer the calm of despotism to the boisterous sea of liberty, and by leaders who were assimilating the rotten as well as the sound parts of the British model. Then, in the line that caused the stir, Jefferson wrote, "It would give you a fever were I to name to you the apostates who have gone over to those heresies, men who were Samsons in the field and Solomons in the council, but who have had their heads shorn by the harlot England." Successive translations of the letter from English to Italian to French, then back to English again, had changed and intensified some of the wording by the time it appeared in the Minerva. Harlot had become whore, for example. But the meaning was essentially unchanged, and the letter was taken by many as an unconscionable attack on Washington. Jefferson said nothing in his defense, and Washington, too, remained silent. But great damage had been done to Jefferson by the Mazzei letter, notwithstanding the many prominent Republicans who claimed he had only been telling the unvarnished truth. Section 2. The President entered Congress Hall at midday, May 16, 1797, absolutely clear in his mind about his intentions, and walked to the dais knowing he had the support of his cabinet in what he was about to say. Indeed, some of the language in the speech he carried was their own, arrived at after he had asked for their answers to a list of specific questions, a technique employed by his predecessor. Long a man of decided temperament, Adams was as determined as he had ever been to maintain the policy of neutrality established by Washington, while refusing to submit to any indignities or to sacrifice American honor. He was determined, in essence, to fulfill his own inaugural promises. But as an old realist, and one who had read more of history and experienced more of it than any of those in his audience, he also knew how extremely difficult, if not impossible, neutrality would be to achieve and maintain in a world at war. He knew how much could happen in France or Britain or on the high seas or within his own country, over which he had no control. Regional and party differences had made a tinderbox of American politics. It was not only that Republicans were divided from Federalists, but Federalists were sharply at odds with themselves, and the role of the strident, often vicious press was changing the whole political atmosphere. Nor was Adams, like George Washington, immensely popular, elected unanimously, and all but impervious to criticism. He had no loyal following as Washington had, no coterie of friends in Congress. Further, there was the looming reality that America at the moment had no military strength on land or sea. With authorization from the Republic of France, French privateers continued to prey on the American merchant fleet at will, and there was no way to stop them. In a calm, steady voice, Adams said the French had inflicted a wound in the American breast, but that it was his sincere desire to see it healed, and to preserve peace and friendship with all nations. He was therefore calling for both a fresh attempt at negotiation with France and a build-up of American military strength. "While we are endeavoring to adjust all our differences with France by amicable negotiation, with the progress of the war in Europe, the depredations on our commerce, the personal injuries to our citizens, and the general complexion of our affairs render it my duty to recommend your consideration of effectual measures of defense." This was not an act of belligerence, but a measure to give added weight and respect to the mission he planned to send to Paris. As was remarked at the time, the speech bore a strong resemblance to the American Eagle, an olive branch in one talon, and in the other, the emblems of defense. Federalist papers hailed Adams's patriotic fire. He had shone forth as in times of old, exciting the liveliest approbation of all real Americans. "It may be justly called a true American speech," said the Gazette of the United States. "It breathes in every line true American patriotism. It came from the heart of a tried patriot, and was addressed to the hearts of patriots alone. There was nothing wavering in it, no little trick to catch a transitory approbation from the discontented or to soothe the fractious. It was the explicit language of the first magistrate of the nation, disclosing to his fellow citizens the honest sentiments of his heart, expressing with proper feeling and sensibility the wrongs done to his injured country, and his determination to attempt to obtain redress, while at the same time it manifested humane anxiety to avert the calamities of war by temperance and negotiations." Federalist approval was emphatic and widespread. From Mount Vernon, Washington wrote that the president had placed matters upon their true ground. Republicans were enraged.